This week on The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
The push to have bigger families and more babies is part of a movement called pronatalism. They are freaking out about declining global fertility rates. And that is real. It's a phenomenon called birth dearth. What's behind this push to start a new baby boom? Who are the voices pushing for a more pro-family America? And what exactly does that mean?
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, streaming now on your favorite podcast app.
Right now in Geneva, tech leaders from across the globe are talking about how to make the future of AI good for people. One critic is hopeful.
Technology development is never inevitable. Technology is always a product of human choices.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the promise of AI and who will really benefit. Also on the program, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is one of the most successful international agreements in history.
Only 9 states have nuclear weapons. That's fewer than 5% of the states in the world.
Attacks on Iran have put that agreement at risk.
But first, young people are protesting in Kenya.
We are still questioning government and begging, literally, for a change.
The police, meanwhile, are cracking down.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's good to be with you. Kenyans are out in the streets this week protesting the government of President William Ruto in almost half of the country's 47 counties.
Police have cracked down on the protests, with both the UN and human rights groups accusing them of using excessive force. At least 31 people have died. Hundreds of protesters have been arrested and many have disappeared.
The demonstrations are driven mostly by young Kenyans who are commemorating what's known as Saba Saba Day. Earlier today, I spoke with Maxie Daniel, a Kenyan human rights activist. They started by explaining the event that protesters are commemorating.
So when you're talking about Saba Saba, Saba Saba, it is a Swahili word which means 7-7. So on 7th July 1990, the people who came before us had the intention of ensuring that the country had a multi-party democracy. And so there was the struggle. And on this struggle, there were activists and citizens who took to the streets demanding for political reforms and to end the one-party rule under President Daniel Arap Moi's regime. Now, when we are looking at 35 years later, you're realizing we are still kind of looking at almost the same thing. We're looking at issues around civic action. We're looking at engaging in the fight for democratic space, justice, and accountability for all the Kenyans. And that is exactly why we are trying to speak in the language that our leaders best know, because we've tried to do dialogues, but it's not working. Now we've decided to take it to the streets.
So I understand you're in your 20s. I'm wondering if you can outline some of the challenges that young people in Kenya face today, specifically young people, that is driving some of these protests.
Thing number one is to ensure that the rate of unemployment goes down, but that has not happened. Instead, more people have not been able to get their job opportunities. Number two, we have scenarios of universities. Now, there are some loans we used to get to for our education. These loans are now being shrinked. What does that the education system look like in that particular moment? Governance and leadership, for example. If young people want to get into leadership positions, there are always the uncles and the brothers and the godfathers who constantly hinder young people from reaching in these particular spaces due to different things like corruption, sextortion, and a whole lot of other things. And lastly, we are also looking at issues around respect of human lives, as I said earlier. The reason why we are going out in the streets, the reason why the challenges that we are facing the biggest is the issue around police brutality and arbitrary arrests. And we are still facing the same issues. We are still questioning government and requesting, begging literally for a change, for us to be able to enjoy living in our country without constantly living in fear as young people in this country.
You didn't want to tell us your specific location for this interview out of concerns for your safety. Could you elaborate a bit more on that? What are the risks for people critical of the Ruto government and other government authorities right now?
A lot of people have been disappearing, broad day kidnappings. Albert Ojwang was picked from his home, apparently banged his head on a wall. Oh, it was a lie. And then the next thing we know is the whole story coming out, and now he no longer banged his head on the wall.
He was a blogger who was critical of the Ruto government.
Yes. So our biggest concern right now is us not being caught and being banged. That is the slang we are using. Every time you say something critical or something questionable, the first thing we are saying is, which kind of wall do you want? It's a bad joke. It's a dark joke. But it's a way for us to constantly remind ourselves of how horrible the situation is in the country right now.
That was Maxi Daniel, a pro-democracy activist in Kenya. To learn more about the allegations of human rights violations against protesters, I spoke to Erungo Houghton. He's the executive director for Amnesty International Kenya, based in Nairobi.
Well, I think the spate of protests that we've had over the last 2 weeks has left Amnesty International extremely worried that the right to assembly is constantly being undermined, either by direct roadblocks or, a ban on the protesters to be able to congregate. What we saw this week on Monday was almost a complete ban on access to the central business district. Of course, the concern has been from the authorities is that there's been a lot of looting, a lot of criminality. But ultimately, we are beginning to get very worried about the use of excessive force against protesters.
Mm.
Over the last year, we've seen close to 100 deaths of protesters, most of whom were unarmed, and many of whom have been killed by gunshot wounds. And guns are really the preserve of the national police.
You know, police brutality is part of what has prompted these protests, and we are also seeing it on the ground. Can you tell me more specifically about the tactics being used by police during these protests?
We can only conclude that with 31 people dead in literally about 6 to 7 hours, that the deaths were essentially of unarmed protesters. And therefore, we have a real concern that people have been targeted.
What is the government saying about the tactics that are being used? I know that William Ruto was saying, you know, we're just trying to prevent the country from descending into violence.
So the government has continually argued that they have used restraint. And there are instances, I think, over the last 3 weeks where the protests have been well managed. I think the Mombasa protest of 25th of June was very well managed. How that happened was essentially the commanding officer reached out to the protesters and they agreed a route and they agreed for the police to escort them. And therefore, the protests remained peaceful. But I think what we have seen more recently is a deterioration into fairly heavy-handed, excessive use of force against, as I say, in most cases, protesters that were unarmed.
Our previous guest raised the issue of disappearances in Kenya. I'm wondering if you can tell us more about that, what evidence there is, if there is evidence that this is happening.
The practice of abductions, or what the UN would classify as enforced disappearances, has spiraled very sharply in the last 1 year or so. I think we've seen a 500% in number of cases of enforced disappearances from previous years. In figure terms, I think it's just about over 100 people have had the experience of being abducted. The 100 or plus cases of abductions have really seen a very similar pattern, which is essentially you are picked up very late at night or in public and you simply disappear. And many of the people who have come back have spoken about cruel and inhuman punishment. They've talked about torture. They've talked about interrogation ad nauseum. And in some cases, these abductions have lasted for even 31 days, which is really shocking, I think, for many Kenyans.
When talking about abductions, are the people being targeted those who have expressed political views in opposition to the government?
Yes. All the abductions that I'm referring to are cases of people who have spoken out, criticized the government either publicly or online. And those are specific cases. I'm not referring to missing persons more generally.
Has the government addressed this at all?
Yeah, the government has spoken about it. The president and several ministers and the Inspector General of Police have referred to the incidents. And many times it comes after a number of protracted legal cases where the Law Society of Kenya has filed an habeas corpus and the courts have instructed the police chiefs to come to court to explain what may have happened or to produce the bodies of the people who had disappeared. And there has been a practice when that has happened for people to be released as the police chiefs are in court or just before they come to court. But I think what we've seen mostly in terms of response has been primarily denial and then a commitment to bring this to an end. Unfortunately, this has not materialized. So there are many, many Kenyans, particularly among the protest movement, who still feel very frightened of being abducted.
Erungu Houghton is the executive director for Amnesty International Kenya. We reached him in Nairobi.
Fentanyl remains the deadliest drug in the United States, but along the U.S.-Mexico border, it was intercepted less in the first half of 2025 than it had been in previous months, a stunning 50% less. From Mexico City, the world's TBC Isaiah looks into why and what the drop in fentanyl seizures means for the U.S.
The U.S.-Mexico border is more fortified now than it's been in many years. Governments on both sides have deployed troops, expanded surveillance, and ramped up inspections to stop the flow of migrants and illicit drugs. By that logic, fentanyl seizures should be going up, but instead they're going down. What's driving this trend isn't entirely clear. David Mora from the International Crisis Group says enforcement in Mexico could be part of the explanation.
The counter-narcotics activity on the Mexico side has increased, in part as an answer to the pressure brought by the Trump administration.
President Claudia Sheinbaum has moved to meet many Trump administration demands to avoid new tariffs. Her government has seized three times more fentanyl this year compared to the same period last year, according to official data. And Mexican authorities say they've dismantled over 100 fentanyl labs in the state of Sinaloa, the heart of the country's synthetic drug industry. Mora says the cartels might also be producing less fentanyl.
The main organization that was behind the fentanyl traffic is involved right now in a major internal infighting.
The Sinaloa cartel, which is believed to control the global fentanyl supply chain, has been redirecting fighters and weapons toward a bloody internal war since September of last year.
So because they're very concentrated in this war, it might be that the business of trafficking, of smuggling drugs into the U.S. has been put on a freeze for the moment.
Also, ingredients might be harder to find. The DEA reports that Mexican fentanyl producers may be struggling to source key Chinese raw material as both China and Mexico crack down under U.S. pressure. So fewer seizures may reflect a drop in production or in shipments. But if there is less drug available in the U.S., then why isn't the price going up?
That suggests that fentanyl continues flowing, but it's being brought in through other means.
That's Vanda Felba-Brown, a fentanyl expert with the Brookings Institution.
Whether this is tunnels, drones, boats in ports like Boston or Miami, instead of going through the land border between U.S. and Mexico.
Another possibility is that demand might be declining. Some researchers say the market has shrunk because the most vulnerable users have already died. And younger Americans, especially in their 20s, are turning away from fentanyl. Also, the drug is now mixed with other products, which may be less appealing to some users.
Other novel substances are being mixed into fentanyl. This could be an indication that the cartels either don't have enough fentanyl or that they are on purpose sending fentanyl that is less potent to reduce drug overdose deaths and in turn thus to reduce pressure from U.S. law enforcement.
In the past few years, synthetic drug overdoses in the U.S. have dropped from 70,000 to roughly 48,000, according to the CDC. But Felba-Brown says whatever else is happening, the drop in deaths is not linked to law enforcement, but to health policy.
This had to do with access to the overdose medication, but it also had a lot to do with increasing insurance coverage for such treatment, most importantly under Medicaid. All of this is now in jeopardy as the Trump administration is heavily focused on reducing supply and retreating from maintaining a public health approach.
With funding cuts already underway, experts warn the progress may not last, regardless of what happens at the border. For the world, I'm TBC Isaiah, Mexico City.
Coming up, a landmark treaty to stop the spread of nuclear arms took effect in 1970. Experts say it's been very successful over the past 55 years. Now the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty may be in jeopardy.
That story is just ahead. Stay with us. You're with the world.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Iran says it's ready to return to nuclear talks, but the country's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, has expressed what he calls good reason to have doubts. In an op-ed in the Financial Times, Araghchi said Iran was, quote, on the cusp of reaching an agreement when Israel started its bombing campaign last month. Now, the government in Tehran is halting cooperation with international nuclear inspectors, raising concerns that Iran might decide to work toward building a bomb. As the World's Matthew Bell reports, that would be a major blow to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons.
Lyndon Johnson negotiated and then signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty at the end of his time in office, but Richard Nixon was president when the treaty went into effect on March 5th, 1970.
I only hope that those of us who were fortunate enough to be present will look back one day and see that this was the first milestone on a road which led to reducing the danger of nuclear war and on a road which led to lasting peace among nations.
Lasting peace among nations is obviously a work in progress. The success of the NPT, though, over the last 5.5 decades is still remarkable. In the mid-1960s, before the treaty was created, it was not unrealistic to think that as many as 24 countries would get the bomb by the following decade. The NPT changed that, says Matthew Bunn. He's an expert on nuclear energy, national security, and foreign policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
It's never been true in human history before that the most powerful weapon available to our species was so widely forsworn.
The grand bargain of the NPT was to limit the number of nations that got the bomb. In 1968, only 5, the U.S., Soviet Union, Britain, France, and China, possessed nuclear weapons. The treaty prohibited them from sharing nuclear weapons know-how, and it's mostly worked.
Yes, there have been states that have tried to get nuclear weapons in violation of the treaty. But right now, today, only 9 states have nuclear weapons. That's fewer than 5% of the states in the world. 35 years ago, 9 states had nuclear weapons. No net increase.
And for the countries without nuclear weapons that signed the NPT, they got help under the terms of the treaty with civilian nuclear technology.
Nuclear technology is now used for medicine, for agriculture, for all sorts of things. And whenever it involves uranium or plutonium or other things that could be used in a nuclear bomb, then there are inspections. Even when it doesn't involve those things, another role of the agency that does those inspections, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is to actually help countries with the benefits of civilian nuclear technology.
The NPT has run into serious challenges over the years. India, Israel, and Pakistan, for example, never signed the treaty, and they all now have nuclear weapons. In the early 1990s, the Soviet Union collapsed, stoking fears about what would happen with its nuclear arsenal. Around the same time, Iraq was discovered to have a secret nuclear weapons program. But probably the thorniest problem for the whole NPT framework is North Korea. Ankit Panda is a nuclear policy expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington.
The North Koreans entered the NPT in 1986, and they essentially are in a continuous crisis as a non-proliferation problem starting in 1991, 1992.
North Korea was caught cheating in various ways. The Clinton administration signed a nuclear deal with the country in 1994, but it fell apart. And the North Koreans ended up leaving the NPT and then conducting their first nuclear test in 2006. Panda says this was a failure for the treaty. But in some ways, the North Korean case was already priced into the global nuclear non-proliferation regime.
By the time 2006 rolls around, you're sort of 15 years into this, will they, won't they, are these, you know, is this country seeking the bomb? And so when the North Koreans do eventually test, it isn't this sort of crisis moment that brings the entire order down, because they're largely seen as a global pariah state without a particular goal of being sort of integrated into the global economy in good standing.
Since leaving the NPT, North Korea is believed to have built dozens of nuclear bombs. But the treaty has been updated over time to address new issues as they've come up. And here's the question experts are now asking about Iran. Will the Islamic Republic, which also signed onto the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, decide to quit the NPT and move toward building a nuclear weapon? David Albright is with the Institute for Science and International Security. He says it's pretty clear that the Iranians violated their treaty obligations by enriching uranium at levels that are really only useful for making a bomb. But the recent airstrikes by Israel and the U.S., Albright says, may end up pushing Iran to go in a different direction.
If Iran gives up its enrichment program, it'll be heralded as a giant victory for nonproliferation, and will probably strengthen the treaty.
Albright says this would also send a powerful signal to other countries that might be thinking about building a bomb themselves.
What you'd have is Saudi Arabia would back down. All the Gulf states would back down. Egypt would breathe a sigh of relief, because their view is, you know, we'll tolerate Israel's having nuclear weapons, but we're not going to tolerate Iran having them. Turkey would, I don't think, it's debatable whether they would seek nuclear weapons as a NATO member, but nonetheless, they would feel less pressure. South Korea would get a very strong message.
Other experts worry that the recent bombing in Iran will only end up pushing the government there away from compliance with the international nonproliferation system. Ankit Panda at the Carnegie Endowment says that's already happening because Iran says it will stop cooperating with inspectors from the IAEA.
There's going to be a lot more ambiguity about everything that's going on in Iran, which means that anybody making an accusation that the Iranians are secretly working towards a bomb is not going to have those accusations kind of have to cohere to anything that the IAEA is saying. And by contrast, anybody making the case that Iran is not building a bomb, including the Iranians themselves, won't really have a basis of evidence to point to.
Panda adds that the current nuclear standoff with Iran was created, at least in part, after the United States violated the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 during President Trump's first term. Matthew Bunn from Harvard says Israeli and U.S. bombing probably set back Iran's nuclear program significantly, but did not destroy it. You can't bomb away the knowledge needed to develop a nuclear weapon, he says. And besides, Bunn says, Iran might still be in possession of its entire stockpile of enriched uranium.
Up until these events, I was still willing to take a bet that 10 years from now, there would be no more states armed with nuclear weapons than there are now. I was already having doubts about that bet before these strikes. Now I really have a lot of doubts. I think I might bet the other way now.
The big worry is that Iran getting the bomb would lead to a new nuclear arms race, putting unprecedented strain on the global nonproliferation system. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. There is a big AI summit in Geneva this week. In just a moment, we'll check in with an industry expert who's there for a conversation about the promise of AI and why she thinks the path it's currently on needs to change. But first, a quick look at recent developments in Ukraine.
Overnight, Russia launched its largest ever drone attack on the country, barraging western Ukraine with nearly 740 drones, decoys, and missiles. Victoria, who asked that we not use her last name, is living in Lusk. She called the attack the worst night of her life.
Like, you are feeling the mix of emotions. You are scared, you are angry, you are just worrying about your family to be okay, and for all the people also to be okay.
The city near the Polish border is home to the Ukrainian army's airfields, making the region a crucial hub for receiving military aid.
Like what the U.S. has promised, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz spoke today about his recent conversations with President Trump. He said he's excited that the U.S. will increase military and civilian aid for Ukraine. Russia, on the other hand, says that's not okay. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson there saying the U.S. resuming military assistance to Ukraine won't help bring about peace.
President Trump is equally frustrated with the Russian president. He said Vladimir Putin is not treating human beings right. Meanwhile, Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky met today with Pope Leo and suggested again that the Vatican would be a perfect spot to hold ceasefire talks. We will keep following that news here on The World.
Now to AI. We hear a lot about the dangers of artificial intelligence, but at this week's AI for Good Summit in Geneva, innovators are showcasing their latest breakthroughs. They have lofty goals like fighting disease, discovering new drugs, battling climate change, and eradicating poverty. That echoes a major talking point for tech companies, that artificial intelligence will benefit all of humanity if only we'd let it. Hong Kong-based journalist Karen Hao sees the potential, but in her new book, Empire of AI, she says this kind of talk from powerful companies sounds like the rhetoric of empire building in the colonial era. Karen Hao is in Geneva. I asked her what she was hearing at the conference.
This year, I feel like there's a very nuanced conversation happening about what we even mean when we say AI. I often like to introduce the term AI as people should think about it like the word transportation. There are so many different types of transportation. You could have bicycles, self-driving cars, rockets, and clearly they all serve different purposes and have different cost-benefit trade-offs. And AI is the same thing. And what we're seeing at this conference is people pausing to first say, are we talking here about large-scale generative AI chatbots, or are we talking about task-specific systems that are targeted at different types of applications? And they're drawing lines between what is considered more beneficial AI development, that is helping drive forward progress, versus the types of AI that actually is really costly, has a lot of climate detriment in the development itself, and we don't actually want to continue investing in.
We'll get into the conference deeper in a moment, but just a quick hit now. What are you hearing there that sounds most promising in its benefits to humanity?
There's plenty of AI systems, AI technologies that are exactly all the things that you mentioned. AI for improving healthcare, AI for mitigating the climate crisis. But by and large, most of these AI systems that are being presented for those beneficial applications are not in any way related to the large-scale generative AI chatbot systems that most people associate with AI systems. So the difference being that generative systems, they're trained on the whole internet kind of indiscriminately, and they use an extraordinary amount of computational resources to ingest that information and ultimately provide a rather entertaining interface to converse with people. But that's not what's going to help mitigate the climate crisis. The things that we would want for mitigating the climate crisis are really task-specific systems that are doing things like discovering new energy storage materials or helping integrate more renewable energy into the grid or increasing the precision of weather prediction, which is just a completely different family of AI technologies. And that is what people are largely focusing on at this conference for what could unlock that benefit.
So, Karen, your book is titled Empire of AI. Not coincidentally, you drew some ideas on how to construct the book around the Netflix series The Crown, having seen it. So in simple, non-techie language, how does the rhetoric used by the companies and institutions pushing the AI revolution, how does it remind you of the language of imperialism?
So what I argue in the book is that companies like OpenAI and their specific choice to develop AI through these large-scale generative systems is what I'm calling imperial. And the reason why is because the systems that they are trying to develop consume an extraordinary amount of resources. They leave rampant environmental harms. They exploit a lot of labor, not just in the way that labor is exploited in the production of the technology, but also they are developing technologies that inherently then are automating a lot of jobs away. And they choose to do this ultimately for consolidating more material resources, more political capital, more financial capital in the hands of the few. So the people that are really benefiting from this dominant AI paradigm today are the Silicon Valley elites that run these companies and are already, you know, billionaires. And the reason why a lot of the rhetoric that they use for saying AI is going to benefit all of humanity, I critique as an empire-building narrative, is because they're pointing to the benefits of bicycles when they're trying to build gas-guzzling trucks. And they're saying, if you give us all of the resources in the world and you give us unfettered access to everything, we will civilize all of humanity, bring progress and modernity everywhere. And that is going to help, you know, everyone go into the future. And that is exactly how empires justified the exploitation of labor, the extraction of resources. They were also under the guise of a civilizing mission.
Right. I see the connection to Buckingham Palace then. Before we go much further, Karen, I just want to be clear that you are not someone with an innate antipathy to tech. You went to MIT, even worked in this industry yourself at one time. What brought you from there to here?
I worked in tech and very quickly realized in this current Silicon Valley model of innovation that we are largely seeing the incentives for producing technologies in that ecosystem becoming deeply misaligned with what is actually in the public interest. By and large, what Silicon Valley incentivizes is the building of profitable technologies, and most of the things that we need technology to do for us in society are not actually profitable problems. You know, mitigating the climate crisis is not, unfortunately, a profitable problem. It's part of the reason why we have not been able to successfully do that mitigation, despite the fact that we have plenty of technologies available to be much further along than we already are. And so I started thinking about how do I cover the tech industry and Silicon Valley's misaligned incentives as a journalist to hold accountable this system that says it's innovating, but is ultimately actually reversing a lot of progress and pushing us back to some of the darkest remnants of our past.
So you've dedicated the book to, quote, movements around the world who refuse dispossession in the name of abundance, end quote. That's pretty deep. Explain what you mean.
What I mean by that is, you know, I went to Chile to interview water activists who are pushing back against data centers creeping into their communities because these AI companies need ever more computing power to train and deploy their models. And those data centers have to be cooled with fresh water. And there was this community in Chile that started pushing back, being like, absolutely not. You cannot take our fresh water. That is our drinking water. We are not going to compete with a data center that ultimately doesn't benefit us, doesn't benefit our country, and also takes away life-sustaining resources. I'm also referring to the fact that there are so many people that are starting to get laid off because the executives at their companies are saying, instead of hiring an entry-level position, instead of training up our current employees, we are going to just pay for an AI model to automate some of that work away. So I do not see evidence at all that the world that these companies are leading us into is actually leading to more abundance broadly distributed.
I'm speaking with journalist Karen Howe, who is at the AI for Good conference in Geneva. She's also the author of the just published Empire of AI. Karen, you were just talking about how AI work has impacted folks in Chile. You found similar things in Kenya, AI companies building wealth off of resource extraction and labor exploitation. Is that trajectory now inevitable, or can AI development kind of be nudged onto a different path?
Technology development is never inevitable. Technology is always a product of human choices. And we are all humans that have choices. I feel like people in the public generally have come to believe that only the people within these companies have the choice to shape what the future of technology will look like. But actually, every single person in the world has a role, an active role to play in shaping the technologies of our future. These companies require our cooperation in order to develop and deploy their technologies. They need extraordinary amounts of data. That data comes from people like us when we post on social media, when artists and writers and creators are producing content. And we are seeing now movements of those artists sue these companies saying, no, you can't just take our data without any credit or compensation. And that is them reclaiming a key piece, a key ingredient of what these tech companies need to develop their AI models. We're seeing hundreds of communities around the world push back on data center development, just like those Chilean water activists. That's them asserting their agency over the future of how this technology might be developed and go. And we're seeing students and teachers actually start wondering, wait a minute, do we want this particular type of AI in our education, or how do we want it? Maybe we want a totally different set of AI technologies that fortify our critical thinking instead of erode it away. And if you think about how many different places you as an individual interface with the AI development supply chain, as I call it, you're giving data or withholding data all the time. You have kids in school. You're going to work at an office that is probably discussing their AI policy right now. These are all sites of democratic contestation where people can assert a voice and agency over how they want AI to be developed, how they want it to be used, and whether they want it to be used at all.
So your critique, and that of one can imagine many people at this conference, is really a critique not of the potential of the technology itself, but really of the way it's being pursued and promoted. Is that correct?
The way it's being pursued in this particular moment as dominated by Silicon Valley companies, yeah.
Hmm. Karen, where do you see the most potential for positive AI, if we can call it that, the ways it can do the most good?
The strength of AI is that it's a computational engine, and there are plenty of computational tasks that we need help with as humans in the world, and that is not a strength of humans. So one example is AlphaFold, which was a system that was developed by London-based firm DeepMind, which won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry last year. And it's a system that is able to accurately predict how a protein folds based on its amino acid sequence, which is a very important step to understanding diseases better, accelerating drug discovery. And that is an inherently computational problem. So that's something that you can take an AI system, you can curate very specific data for training that system, and then you can set that system on attacking this targeted problem. Also, detecting cancer in medical images, like that's something that we've had for a technology we've had for a really long time, also very computational in nature. If you curate a bunch of MRI scans that show a very specific type of cancer and train an AI model just on that type of cancer in the hands of a well-trained doctor, studies have shown that you can then detect the cancer far earlier and allow the patient to engage in earlier interventions that might help them kick the cancer. And so those are the things that I see as we absolutely need more of that AI if it is well-curated data, well-designed, well-scoped, targeting that computational problem. And that is, a far cry from where most of the investment in AI development is going today.
Yeah, I just came across a personal example of cancer detection through AI. So that is really remarkable. More than 2.5 billion people on the planet, about a third of the world's population, do not have access to the internet, which is really striking. Do the benefits of AI leave them out?
A huge theme of the conference is the connectivity gap, the digital gap, and how AI could exacerbate that. And I absolutely do think that, AI is ultimately a digital technology. It requires the internet, it requires computing infrastructure, it requires data. And if those 2.5 billion people are not necessarily leaving data trails anywhere to be trained on. So there is a huge question of not just whether or not they will be able to use AI and benefit from it, but also whether that AI will be representative of them. If you're training a cancer model, it can do great on Western populations because there's plenty of data from Western populations on that type of cancer in their MRI scans. But will it translate then to a context in Kenya or a context in Colombia? So ultimately, many people have been saying at this conference that we need to continue to remember as we try to advance AI that there are plenty of other challenges that need to be advanced as well in order to even unlock AI for a significant part of the world.
So you're at a conference focused on how AI can really play a big role in bringing sustainability to people's lives in many areas. The UN actually has a global target for reaching its sustainability goals, 2030. So in the 4.5 years before that deadline, what do you expect to see happen between the forces that want an AI gold rush and the folks who really want to push AI into the sustainability lane?
Well, right now, the Silicon Valley companies and their dominant vision of AI is rapidly reversing our climate progress. So there was actually a UN report that just came out showing that there's been an extraordinary rise in carbon emissions from the four main AI developers. And it's specifically because of the amount of data centers that they are laying to try and develop and deploy their AI systems, because these data centers need to be powered primarily with fossil fuel energy sources. So we're seeing reports of coal plants having their lives extended after they were supposedly up for retirement. We're seeing reports of methane gas turbines being laid down just to power single data centers. And so if we allow these companies to continue accelerating in the way that they're accelerating, they will continue to pump ever more carbon emissions into the air. And there's also plenty of task-specific AI systems that could help continue to fight the climate crisis. There was a keynote this morning from Sasha Lucioni, who is the AI and climate lead at Hugging Face, one of the largest open source AI platforms. And she was talking about all of the opportunities potentially of using these task-specific models to get more renewable energy integrated onto the grid, to have that higher accuracy weather prediction. And so really, it is in our hands which path we choose, which AI we invest in, and how we want it to play a role in our lives and shape our future.
Karen Howe is at the AI for Good Summit in Geneva. Her new book is Empire of AI. Karen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. I, for one, am very excited about this news that the TSA is dropping its infamous no-shoes rule for passengers going through airport security. No more frantically pulling off shoes and walking through checkpoints in socks. The World's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, is here to give me the lowdown. Jeremy, I kind of forget, or maybe I just have lucked it out. Is the shoe thing just in the U.S., or do a lot of countries do it?
It's confusing, and it's a patchwork of rules. So let's look at the EU first here. The bloc itself has its own universal set of security standards, and those do not technically include having to take your shoes off. But individual countries, airports, even specific flights can all have their own standards that are stronger than the EU rules. Also, in several other countries around the world, like Japan, South Korea, Australia, most of Africa, South America, the Middle East, you generally can keep them on. But Carolyn, all of this is basically on a case-by-case basis because there's no single international rule. So
Right. You
never really know what to expect. And airport security will always be, I don't know, let's say, confusing and not very pleasant.
Yeah. And according to the official announcement, I understand this is being driven by a desire to make airport security a little more pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
But this no shoes rule, it was instituted at first for safety. Why are they now able to remove that safety protocol?
It's because they say the scanner technology that they have at this point is good enough to be able to screen passengers without taking off their shoes. And the interesting thing here, Carolyn, is that these improvements in technology have actually helped some other countries make improvements to their systems. So one example is just this week, some airports in Scotland announced you can now travel with containers holding up to 2 liters of liquid. But I want to caution that all of this can, of course, change on a dime. Like in the EU last summer, Rome and Amsterdam installed these machines and eased their liquid rules. But then because of a technical issue, the EU ended up reinstating the 100 milliliter rule again.
All these rules, they're hard to keep track of.
Yeah.
Do we know if all of these specific rules have actually prevented dangerous incidents on flights?
The short answer is we don't really know. There's a large group of experts actually in the field who say most of this, the shoes, the liquids, the taking out your computer, putting toiletries in a bag, it's all just security theater. In a test conducted by the TSA in 2017, undercover agents were able to sneak dummy firearms, explosive, and knives through security 70% of the time.
Wow.
But there is a silver lining here, Carolyn, which is that security technology is advancing rapidly. And the UN agency that helps set international standards, as I reported recently, is already starting to imagine a future where security and customs are a lot simpler, using things like biometric scans to cut hours of queuing into something that can happen in an instant. That's years and years away, but it's something to look forward to.
The World's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel.
In France, people in remote villages across the country are raising their glass to a bill that's working its way through Parliament. It would make it easier to open cafes and bars in places that are off the beaten track. As it stands, some 20,000 French hamlets are essentially without any bars. That means no place to gather, gossip, and sip a beer or a pastis. The Bring Bars Back proposal is meant to breathe more life into rural France. Back in March, the world's Jerry Haddon took a swing through the country's least populated region, the Eastern Pyrenees, asking the question, where can a guy get a drink around here?
I'm in a mountain hamlet called Jujol, population 55. It's basically a small cluster of stone houses. Hardly a place you'd find a Hard Rock Cafe, or, it turns out, any cafe.
Bonjour, madame.
Excuse me, I ask resident Nathalie Domé. She's out trimming the hedge in front of her cottage. Is there a cafe in town to wet my whistle? A drink, she says. You've got zero options. No cafe, no bar, no bistro. Nathalie's husband, Pierre, joins us. Of course, it'd be great if we had some place to get together, he says. We talk about it from time to time. If you want to have a drink in a public place, he says, you need to drive down the winding mountain road 3 miles to a village below. It's complicated, he says. You need a designated driver. One who sticks to soft drinks, Nathalie says. French lawmaker Guillaume Casparion says a bar or bistro in places like this could spark a modest little renaissance, maybe even convince young people not to leave. But he told French radio recently France's bureaucracy makes it just about impossible to open a place that serves alcohol. Right now, it's illegal to hand out new liquor licenses in France, he said, citing a law that dates back to 1941. The only way to get a license is to wait until someone who has one in your area wants to sell it. It can take a long time, he says, if it happens at all, and can cost tens of thousands of dollars. Casparion's just gotten a bill through the lower house of France's parliament that would allow new liquor licenses in villages with less than 3,500 residents. He's been touring around the countryside, recording interviews in places with bars to underscore what a difference that can make. One bar owner tells him, people come in for the warmth of human company. Contrast that with the silence on the empty streets of Jujol, and you get Casparion's point. But just as I'm leaving the supposedly dry mountain village, neighbor Nathalie Domé says there might be a place where you can buy a beer. She tells me about Alain, a retired guy who lives at the end of the road in the very last house.
Bonjour. C'est la maison où on peut acheter.
The gray-bearded Alain is easy to find. When I tell him what I'm after, he leads me into his garage and cuts open a cardboard box. Inside, bottles of an artisanal beer he says he's allowed to sell. His price, around $3 a pop.
Ta-da. Cheers.
Cheers.
Salut.
Un bon weekend, ça va être 10.
On a busy weekend, Alain says, I can sell up to 10 of these. It's a pretty small operation. So small, he can't let his clients imbibe on his property. That'd require that hard-to-get liquor license. So he tells me what he tells everyone with a fresh brew in their hand, but nowhere to go.
His recommendation was to come sit in front of town hall and drink my beer. That's a first.
And maybe a last if France does allow for new liquor licenses in towns like this. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Jujol, France.
Since Jerry first reported the story in March, the lower house of France's parliament voted overwhelmingly to allow more cafes and bars in rural towns. The Senate has yet to take action.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can now find us on YouTube at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life, luminafoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation, by the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Janae Elzey, Vicky and Michael Isip, Genji Kohan, Ashton Peary and Kate Wolf, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.